From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To The Point.
Is it geoengineering or hacking the climate? Hello again, I'm Warren Olney, and this is a special rebroadcast of To The Point. A raging dispute among climate scientists is breaking out into the open. Could they slow global warming by injecting aerosols into the atmosphere to reflect sunlight? Or are the unintended consequences potentially so dangerous that even experimentation should be prohibited? The idea is gaining some traction, but opponents say it's beyond reckless. Would trying to resolve one problem create others that could get out of control? On our talking point later, a photojournalist looks at America's class and political divisions through a new lens, a cross-country tour of McDonald's. First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24, or you can listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To The Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with a special rebroadcast of To The Point. Happy Independence Day. With the U.S. backing out of the Paris Agreement, scientists are looking at extreme options to slow global warming. Is it time to try altering the atmosphere by what's called geoengineering? We'll hear about unintended consequences, international relations, and ethics. First, this news update. President Obama and the Pentagon ordered America's armed services to welcome transgender recruits. The plan is now being delayed. President Trump's Defense Secretary Jim Mattis is giving the chiefs of staff another 6 months to determine if transgender enlistments will, quote, affect the readiness or lethality of the services. Aaron Belkin is director of the Palm Center, promotes the study of LGBT issues in the military. He's author of How We Won, the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Welcome back.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So given what's happening now in the military, if you're transgender, is it pretty much don't ask, don't tell?
It's complicated. It is don't ask, don't tell. So transgender service members have been serving for a year, and they've been serving openly, and they've been serving successfully and widely praised by their commanders. But what they're not allowed to do is apply to the military in the first place as a transgender person and get into the military. And so what the Trump administration did this week was delay the repeal of the enlistment ban, meaning that transgender people cannot apply for military service. And that, of course, has a chilling effect on people who are already in the military.
So there are two categories of people then, those who are in the military already and those who want to be. What's happening is we're not going to have any more for another 6 months.
Well, if it's only 6 months, that's really not a terrible thing. I mean, administrative policies get delayed by a short time on a regular basis. So that's not a big deal. The concern here is that there is clearly an alliance between some very anti-LGBT generals at the, in particular at the top of the Army, and some fairly extremist members of Congress who are working to try to dismantle inclusive policy. So the six-month delay is really not about a six-month delay. It's about a beginning step in an effort to roll back all of inclusive policy.
Does anybody know how many transgender people there are in the military now?
Yeah, there are different estimates, and the low-range estimate is about 2,000, and the high-range estimate is about 15,500. And so it's very common in social science to have a range of estimates, but the best way to think about it is several thousands.
What is this going to mean to them in terms of getting out of the closet and even getting surgery?
When the military says you are not welcome to apply as a transgender person, what that's saying is that you're a second-class citizen. And so technically, transgender people in the military are allowed to come out of the closet and are allowed to get medical care that they need. But the problem is, if they do that, then they can be asked, well, why didn't you tell the truth at the time of enlistment? Why didn't you tell us that you were transgender when you were applying to get into the military? Because if you had, we wouldn't have let you in. And transgender people know that they're going to be vulnerable to that question, and that's going to have a chilling effect on their ability to serve honestly and, of course, to obtain the medical care that they need.
Is there going to be pressure to have them get the surgery they need before they enlist so the military doesn't have to pay for it?
Every transgender person is different, and some require surgery and some don't. So I wouldn't think about the situation in terms of pressure to get surgery or not to get surgery, but the real issue is, will service members get the medical care that they need? And for every non-transgender service member, they're entitled to all medical care that they need. The problem is that until last year, transgender people were the one group who were not entitled to the medical care they need. And so the Obama administration started to change that, but now the Trump administration is trying to roll that back.
At the beginning of our interview, you said that their records are stellar. Elaborate a bit on that. How well have they done, and in what kinds of situations?
There's a great deal of research on LGBT service in military organizations around the world. So 18 foreign militaries allow transgender people to serve, Israel, Canada, Britain, Australia, and none have reported any problems with readiness or cohesion. And what the research has shown again and again is that inclusive policy promotes readiness. And you know, that's not a surprise. When people are allowed to be honest about who they are, they can better do their jobs. When they get the health care they need, they're better service members. So for the past year, transgender troops have been allowed to serve openly in the U.S. military. We're the 19th military to make that decision. And there have been, at the Palm Center, we've been tracking about 24 transgender service members throughout the year. And they've done very well. Some of them have transitioned, some of them have not. But they have been praised by their commanders, and there have been no implementation problems whatsoever that we're aware of.
So what about this question of the readiness or lethality of the services?
No, that's the problem, is that this is just like Don't Ask, Don't Tell. The military already knew a year ago, at the end of its year-long study period, that there were no problems with transgender military service. The RAND Corporation had done a big study about this. The former U.S. Surgeon General had done research. Retired generals and admirals had done research. The military knew quite well. The military had done its own research. There's no problem with transgender military service. What's going on now is the same thing that we saw under Don't Ask, Don't Tell, that even though the military knows that transgender inclusion promotes readiness, they're lying about that because they don't like transgender people. They don't want, specifically people at the top of the Army, don't want transgender people to serve. So instead, they make up arguments about concerns about readiness that they know are not true.
Aaron Belkin with the Palm Center in San Francisco, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
In a moment, is it geoengineering or hacking the climate? On To the Point from PRI.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. With the Trump administration backing out of the Paris Agreement on climate change, scientists, not to mention local governments, are looking at other options. One idea that once was beyond the pale is now out in the open. It's geoengineering. That means releasing aerosols into the atmosphere to reflect sunlight and cool the planet. David Keith is Harvard Professor of Applied Physics and Public Policy. Welcome to our program.
Great to be here. Thank you.
That's very much a layman's description of geoengineering. Maybe you can make it a little clearer than I did.
Oh, I can give it a shot. The idea, which has really been around in some form for 40 years or so, is that when humans might be able to deliberately make the planet a little more reflective, say by putting aerosols, which are very fine particles, like a fine droplet in a cloud or a droplet of dust, into the upper atmosphere where they stay for a couple years, and to put those aerosols in so they reflect away a tiny bit of sunlight that would reduce the kind of net energy imbalance of the Earth, if you like, that's created by the buildup of carbon dioxide, the thing that's causing climate change. And that would temporarily and quite imperfectly reduce the amount of climate change that happens, and so reduce some of the risks of climate change for a given amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And I guess to me, the bottom line is, at best, this is a supplement to cutting emissions. We have to cut emissions of carbon dioxide to zero eventually if we want a stable climate, but it may be a very powerful supplement that really reduces risks a lot, risks especially to some of the world's poorest and to ecosystems, but it comes with a lot of risk and uncertainty itself. So the big question now is how much research we do, I think.
By research, do you mean experimentation, actually trying it?
not trying to do it at scale. I don't think that makes any sense. There's a whole set of small sort of geophysical experiments that are, I think, do make sense. We're working on one of them ourselves. So that ranges from laboratory experiments to small field experiments. But these are not field experiments that aim to change the climate. They'd be tiny in that regard, but they'd be trying to understand some of the key physics and chemistry of the way the climate works that helps inform our models of how these techniques might work at large scale.
Tell us a little bit more about the experimentation that you are planning on conducting. What would it look like?
Well, so the first thing we're doing is laboratory experiments. And so we're this is all in regard to the possibility of putting aerosols in the stratosphere, which is one, but only one of the ideas for solar geoengineering. And we're particularly interested in understanding the environmental consequences of doing that. So one of the big concerns for decades has been that putting some aerosols in the stratosphere, sulfate aerosols in particular, can accelerate ozone loss. That ozone loss is ultimately caused by the chlorine compounds that humans put there through fluorocarbon emissions. And so we're interested in finding ways to understand and predict that more accurately, and also to find ways to reduce the ozone loss or even reverse it, so we actually help restore the ozone layer. So the experiments are experiments on the kinds of particles that might go in the stratosphere, like on calcium carbonate, kind of something like powdered limestone, or on sulfuric acid, the different sorts of particles people have talked about putting in the stratosphere. We're doing experiments in the laboratory to look at chemical reactions. And then we're, you know, slowly moving towards a field experiment that builds on previous field experiments we've done that would do small experiments from a balloon.
From a balloon. So it wouldn't be in the stratosphere, or would it be?
Oh, yeah, it would be in the stratosphere.
Okay.
The group that I'm part of has had a long history of doing stratospheric science that helped to untangle the cause of the ozone hole. And so we've built stratospheric instruments in the group for decades. And so this would be, in some sense, similar to that, but we'd be doing a manipulative experiment and that we'd be releasing a small amount of some aerosol, say calcium carbonate. But and then measuring over a day what it does to the local chemistry of the stratosphere.
All right, David Keith at Harvard. Again, you've said this was temporary and imperfect, a supplement to cutting global warming gases that we are now emitting. Raymond Pierre Humbert is with us. He's a professor of physics at Oxford, at the University of Oxford. It's good to have you on our program.
Hello, it's nice to be here, yes.
You have said that this is not just tricky, but wildly, utterly, howlingly, barking mad. What do you mean?
Well, I'd say, you know, I think David and I are more or less in agreement that this is a terrifying thing to do. It's the question of at what point, if ever, does it make sense to do research on it and develop the technologies. But the essential problem with geoengineering, the reason I think that this is really would be very premature even to do the kinds of experiments David is talking about right now, is the problem of time scales. That is, carbon dioxide that we emit today continues to affect the climate for thousands, even tens of thousands of years. If we don't actually succeed in getting our emissions all the way down to zero, the geoengineering, the solar geoengineering, or I would prefer to call it albedo modification, because we don't know enough about the system to really say that we're engineering it. Whatever you call it, if we don't get our emissions down to zero, that means that the amount of warming grows year after year after year. And so whatever you do to try to cancel out some of that with shooting something into the stratosphere, you have to do more of it each year. And so unless you can demonstrate that we actually have the ability to bring our emissions down to zero, this is a useless technology. It's not even a stopgap. And there's the danger that if you do it to a certain extent, that you manage to succeed in reducing a certain amount of the warming, people will just forget that there's a problem altogether and just emit more and more carbon dioxide, leading to this sort of death spiral where you're emitting more carbon dioxide, doing more geoengineering, until the point where a war or something happens, you suddenly have to stop your geoengineering. Then you have all that accumulated warming that will hit you in just 10 or 15 years. And so I can imagine a sort of very well-regulated world where everybody is in agreement and we just do a little bit of this and we are going to get our emissions down to zero. But in a world where Donald Trump is president, that's not the world we live in. And so I think this is a very dangerous technology to unleash at this point, even at a small scale.
Back to David Keith, it sounds like maybe you're not in agreement, even though Professor Humbert says you might be.
No, I actually think there's a lot of agreement there. But remember, we're scientists. We don't make the political decisions. So it's absolutely true, as Ray said, that in the long run, if you don't bring emissions to zero, the underlying climate problem just keeps getting worse. No argument whatsoever. Both Ray and I spent lots of our lives trying to argue that people should cut emissions. And it's important to say that despite the lunacy of Donald Trump, there's progress. The last 3 years, there's been no increase in emissions. And there's been enormous progress on solar power getting cheaper. And I think there is reason to believe we'll eventually bring emissions down. But my view is that this technology may reduce the risks, however quickly we bring emissions down. And that a technology that could profoundly reduce risks, and that's what it shows from the whole suite of climate models we have, and there's basic reasons of basic physics to believe it as well, could substantially reduce risks, especially risks for the poorest among us, people who are most vulnerable to climate change, say risks from extreme events like tropical cyclones, that it makes sense to investigate it seriously, to understand what its risks are and how well it could work, and to bring it out in the open. Basically, I believe that sunlight is a good disinfectant of these ideas, and we need them in the open so people can freely see them and debate them.
That's
one of the things that Ray said implicitly was the assumption that if we keep emitting CO2, then we have to keep increasing this. That's an assumption about how it gets used. It's not a scientific statement. It's an implicit assumption that the goal is going to be to keep temperatures constant. But it's a political decision what the goal is. And it would certainly be meaningful to do solar geoengineering temporarily as a way to reduce the rate of change. And the overwhelming evidence from the climate impacts community, people who study the impacts of climate on natural systems and human systems, is the rate of change is a big driver of risk.
David Keith, once again at Harvard. We'll come back to him and to Professor Humbert at Oxford as well. But first, here is the Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, former CEO of ExxonMobil, of course. Here's what he said to the Council on Foreign Relations in 2012.
It's an engineering problem, and it has engineering solutions. And so the fear factor that people want to throw out there to say, we just have to stop this, I do not accept.
Simon Nicholson is co-founder of the Forum for Climate Engineering Assessment. Good to have you on our show.
Yeah, thanks for it.
Mr. Tillerson said it's an engineering problem. Does that suggest that if, in fact, the geoengineering that we've talked about, or solar engineering, as Professor Humbert calls it, were, in fact, implemented, that there would be a tendency to say, wait a minute, this is an engineering problem, we're dealing with it, we don't have to cut back on emissions after all?
Yeah, so far from your other guests, the conversation has been mainly about the physical and environmental implications of moving in this direction. What's been hinted at is that there are lots of very profoundly troubling political questions in this space. And one of the most profound political questions is what this means for the rest of the climate response agenda. We could imagine that if this gets dangled out in front of the international community as some kind of solution, as a kind of a plan B, as some have talked about it, then it might really distract from the need to, as both of your guests have already suggested, cut emissions to zero. And that would be the worst outcome of trying to treat climate change as an engineering problem. It's much, much bigger and more challenging than that.
Elaborate, if you will, on what some of the other kinds of consequences might be, particularly the political ones.
Yeah, so there are a lot of potential political challenges attached to even investigation in this space. The one that I just mentioned is often called the moral hazard, and that is it might distract from the need to cut emissions. But others talk about the potential danger, for instance, of discovering down the road after a research program is underway that it's a bad idea, but we're already locked into a pathway that takes us to deployment. And this is either a slippery slope argument, or some call it a technological lock-in argument. Now, these sorts of problems are surmountable. We can imagine developing forms of governance, forms of institutions and so forth around even research that might limit the potential negative implications of moving in this direction. But some have gone so far as to say that climate engineering is actually ungovernable, and that's something that Ray was starting to hint at in his comments.
Ungovernable. What do you mean by that?
Well, yeah, so to get back to Ray's point, if we imagine that this will have to be something that's deployed, a sulfate shield in the stratosphere, to use a common example, if it has to be deployed not just for decades but potentially for millennia, it's hard to think of other instances where the human species has been able to sustain something cooperatively across that time span. And another challenge in this space, the normal way to think about climate change, if we're going to respond to it, is to have the entire global community come together around aggressive emissions reductions targets. It requires action from basically everybody on the planet. It's a big cooperative, coordinated action problem. The challenge with something like solar geoengineering is that one country could potentially go it alone. So the United States has the industrial capacity, so does China, Russia, many other countries, to launch a research program and potentially deployment of a sulfate shield. And that sets up a whole set of interesting kind of international political questions at a moment, as has been hinted, when it's not clear that the international community is able to rationally have these sorts of conversations.
Simon Nicholson at the Climate Engineering Assessment Forum. Ray Humbert, back to you at the University of Oxford. Talking with our producer today, you said that in some ways this reminds you of the development of the atomic bomb.
Well, yes. I mean, people go back and forth about how apt the analogy is and how far along that spectrum we are. But I was thinking particularly the hydrogen bomb, because the question about whether the hydrogen bomb should ever have been developed by the U.S. is a lot more fuzzy than the question of the first atomic bomb. But
because
yes,
we already knew what the consequences might be. Is what you're
yes,
saying?
Yes. And so this is just a way of saying that. That there are some kinds of research that are really not innocuous. Once you unleash a technology, it's almost inevitably going to be deployed. And we do decide that some technologies are just essentially not governable or too dangerous to ever be put into practice. So we try not to do research on biological weapons. We do very little on chemical weapons. I think the knowledge about how to make sarin gas is something that a lot of people would wish that we never had.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we're running short of time for this break. We're going to go to a break, and we'll come back to all of you after that. But David Keith at Harvard, I'd like you to respond, if you will, briefly to what we have just heard from both our other guests.
Well, so both are implicitly assuming it has to be done for millennia. And if that's the assumption, then I completely agree it makes no sense to do it, and it's stupid. But that's an assumption that has no foundation. There's no reason to do that. It's a public policy choice. And if you actually think about the risks to people from climate change over this next century, reducing the rate of change could have profound benefits. And that's true even if you only do it for one century. So the claim that you have to do it forever is a claim that is rhetorically effective, because, of course, if it's true, then, yeah, we can't guarantee doing it forever. That'd be crazy. But it's a claim that's not based on a kind of coherent thinking through of the way climate policy will evolve.
What about the idea that if it were offered as a solution, we wouldn't, in fact, then try to reduce emissions to zero?
Well, that's been the largest concern. I think I was one of the first to raise that concern and to call it moral hazard. But it's by no means a done deal. And in fact, it can go both ways. So I think the answer is yes, Exxon will certainly use it, or other oil companies, as a way to try and argue against emissions cuts. I think that already has happened a little bit and likely will happen some more.
All right. We need to take a very brief break. We'll continue this conversation after that. On our talking point later, America's political divisions seen through a cross-country tour of McDonald's. This is To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Warren Ollie back with The Point, once again talking about geoengineering, also called solar engineering, the idea that we could inject into the atmosphere materials that would reflect sunlight away and thus cool the atmosphere. And we've heard that there is a lot of dispute among scientists about whether it's a good idea. Jack Stilgo is a senior lecturer in the Department of Science and Technology Studies at the University of College London. Welcome to you.
Hello, good afternoon.
What are some of the ethical issues involved in this?
I think we've already touched upon them. I mean, Simon Nicholson certainly mentioned the sort of the geopolitical dimensions of all of this. I think there's a sort of a fairly fundamental ethical question, though, about whether we are, as a species, ready to take responsibility for an aspect of our lives that has, until very recently, you know, we've referred to the weather and the climate as acts of God, right? This is one of those areas that human beings have claimed that they don't have any control over. And as soon as the human race starts down that road, I think that raises some gigantic ethical questions, and we don't yet have the capacity to take those on.
Well, haven't we already gotten in the way of what might be acts of God by emitting into the atmosphere so much stuff that the planet is warming?
So indeed, and this is sometimes a justification for geoengineering research, if not geoengineering the deployment of technologies, is that, in effect, we've already done this rather disastrous experiment of climate change, so therefore organizing that experiment a bit better wouldn't be such a gigantic ethical leap. I don't buy that argument because I think we need to take intention seriously. And I think as soon as we intentionally start controlling things, then that changes the nature of the game. But if we take the viewpoint of global ethics, doesn't say anything about, well, who is it that's making these decisions, right? The question is not whether we as the human race all get together and make sensible decisions together, because that has never happened in the past, right? This would be some particular groups of people who would have enormous technological power concentrated in their hands, making decisions about the fate of the planet. Unprecedented, one could argue.
Would they likely to be middle-aged white guys, such as all of us that are talking on this in this conversation?
Well, quite. And I think, you know, I think we need to realize what a small world we represent in having this conversation. We need to realize how little we know about what the world's most vulnerable people would think about this as an option for dealing with climate change. So, you know, if we're talking about research questions, I think we need to be looking at research, finding out what those people that we think are going to benefit from geoengineering, right? David Keith was suggesting that this may help the most vulnerable people in the world. What might they actually think? Those people that have been largely alienated from the last 50 years of technological progress, would they think that this new concentration of power were a good thing? Now, I don't know. As a social scientist, I want to ask that question, but my suspicions are that there would be a huge amount of skepticism.
David Keith, let me go back to you again, a public policy and physics professor at Harvard University and a researcher into solar geoengineering. Go ahead.
Two comments. One is, I absolutely agree with Jack Stilgo about intention, so I don't buy the argument that because we're already messing it up by putting CO2 in, that it's okay to mess it up some more. I agree with him. I absolutely agree that we need to really engage and try and understand what the people in the most vulnerable places actually think, and we're doing that. So we've had active research efforts, say, in the Philippines and in India, who are going out and asking people what they think and engaging with people in governments there, and indeed other countries as well. The answers are pretty surprising and diverse, so I don't think they necessarily go along with Jack's supposition. And I think there's a second part of Jack's supposition, which is that this concentrates power. But I think that's not obvious at all. Think about the way technologies like the internet, other technologies that are cheap to reproduce once you have the idea, have actually in some ways made power both more concentrated in some hands, but also more diffuse around the world. These technologies are pretty cheap, and there's no particular intellectual property controls. They're pretty easy to copy. So far, this conversation has been sort of somehow assuming that Donald Trump and the White House matter, or this is a thing the U.S. does. My guess is it's not what the U.S. does. My guess is if it happens, it's motivated more by countries that are suffering effects of climate change more strongly, countries like India or Philippines, Indonesia, wherever. And those are countries that easily can do it, because once the ideas are out there, once the science is done, there isn't any control over who does it. So I think it's not necessarily true that this concentrates power. If anything, it may diffuse power.
Raymond Pierre Humbert, back to you, a professor of physics at the University of Oxford. You're opposed to even doing research and experimentation, as I understand it. Would this, like global warming, have effects of causing, you know, flooding in one area, desertification in another area? Would it be possible to predict the kinds of things that might happen around the world as a result of fooling with the atmosphere?
Well, I, that's a very interesting question, but I'm afraid I'm going to set that aside because it's important to respond to a rather absurd thing David said a bit earlier, that we don't have to do this geoengineering forever because you could always decide to stop. That's technically true, but it's like saying that if you get yourself into a state where you're a diabetic because of bad life choices, you don't have to take insulin forever. You could always stop. Of course, the consequences are that you die. And so I think that the range of circumstances in which you have an exit strategy for stopping the albedo modification, the solar engineering, are very narrow. They involve things like whether you have developed technologies for taking CO2 out of the atmosphere rapidly enough. There are ideas to do that, but we don't know whether they can really scale or whether there's the political will to actually deploy them. And so I just don't buy the argument that we can always choose to stop if we don't like it. You can get yourself into a state where it's essentially an addiction, and if you stop, you cause major crises.
Well, before we get then to my question, let's go back to David Keith and get you respond to what we just heard with regard to whether or not you could stop and or this would become a comparable to something like an addiction.
I think there's certainly a danger of the addiction, but let's really play the moral of this out. I feel like the argument that Ray is making in its core is that he doesn't trust people with this technology. The kiddies won't use it right. We're going to have a technology that might potentially reduce risk, but people will, instead of having their risk reduced, just have worse behavior. So let's play the analogy out. Does that mean that Ray would, say, oppose anti-AIDS drugs or other drugs for sexually transmitted diseases because the result might be that people engage in more risky behavior? Well, the answer is they do sometimes, but that's not a morally sound reason to oppose things that actually can reduce risks.
Okay. Professor Humbert, I have to give you an opportunity to respond. Go ahead.
Yes. I mean, the essential question there is whether this is a technology that actually is even potentially useful in reducing risks. And I would say that if we actually can demonstrate that the world has the maturity to even begin taking the steps needed to bring the CO2 emissions down to zero, if we can agree to do that sort of thing, then we have the maturity as a global political entity to actually perhaps make geoengineering governable. But until you actually make the case, until there's a pathway that not just stabilizes the CO2 emissions, but actually has them starting down to zero, we don't know whether the geoengineering, whether albedo modification, solar geoengineering, is even in a position to reduce the risks.
Okay. Well, let me go to Simon Nicholson again at the Forum for Climate Engineering Assessment. Let me ask you about this question of unintentionally causing floods or droughts or other kinds of disruptions that would have an impact on people, and unpredictable impact, perhaps, by this kind of geoengineering. Are you concerned about that?
Yeah, that claim, Warren, is based on a set of modeling studies that were done a few years ago. And what those modeling studies did is they had the understanding that this type of climate engineering that we're talking about might be quite rapid and would be across a very steep curve. And what I mean by that is they tried to really turn down temperatures very rapidly. When they did that in the models, then you started to see some weather implications that were troubling. Some folks pointed to, for instance, the potential to shut off monsoon rains in South Asia. But the sort of solar geoengineering that David is talking about, in part informed by those studies, is a little different. It's not to try and take us back to some prior Earth, but rather to try and reduce climate risks over, in the way that he talks about it, a shorter term.
Let me go back to Jack Stilgo again at the University College in London. What do you say to the question of who would be helped and who wouldn't? Would this, in fact, be good for the poorest and most vulnerable, India, for example? Would they be likely, do you think, to get on board? Could we have some kind of unanimity or something close to it worldwide?
Well, I think the first point is to say that when we start those sort of cost-benefit analyses, right, are we thinking about the impact on weather and how those might influence people's ability to grow crops and things that would be materially important to them? I mean, that might be one consideration. But also, let's think about how people in the global south have or haven't benefited from grand technological schemes in the past. And there, the history of technology provides a pretty patchy story. I mean, there are examples of major technological successes that have alleviated poverty, like vaccines. But there are also examples where there are more examples where technologies have widened the gap between rich and poor, just because powerful people are able to take advantage of those technologies. And to the point that this would be relatively cheap and easy, I think that's something that we need to question. I mean, it's an idea that has been allowed to determine the debate up to now, is that, in effect, this, you know, solar geoengineering would be orders of magnitude cheaper than dealing with climate change in the sort of messy, expensive way that we've been doing up till now. And I think the honest answer is that we have absolutely no idea how cheap it would be, right? These ideas haven't left the drawing board. And if we start the research that to try to work out the full social and technological complexity of the thing, we might find out that actually this is a whole lot more difficult, just as nuclear power turned out to be a whole lot more difficult to deliver once you add in all of the complexities. And once we realize those difficulties, maybe we'll stop speculating about it and we'll turn our attention to other things.
Now that there is public discussion of this, which there hasn't been before, it's my understanding that there already is a sort of conspiracy theory community, if you will, growing up about it. And people who mistakenly believe that the government is doing this and it's going to do it to us, and the sort of arguments that we often hear in other context. Jack Stilgo, is that in fact already happening, and is it going to be necessary to cope with it?
There is a conspiracy theory out there that has got wrapped up in the geoengineering debate. I, as a social scientist, see that as a huge shame, because I, like David Keith, would want a forceful and widespread democratic discussion about the goods and bads of geoengineering. And if people are mixing up geoengineering with ideas about chemtrails and such, then I think that overshadows that discussion. So I think it's a gigantic and unhelpful distraction.
Simon Nicholson, is it possible that there could be international destabilization, as we've heard suggested?
That's one thing that people have been concerned about, certainly. And so one story that's often told in the space is about attribution. A few years ago, there was a gigantic flood in the Indus River in Pakistan. And one could imagine that if a few years prior, India had announced a research program and potential deployment of sulfate particles into the atmosphere, whether or not it was that solar geoengineering that caused the flooding, you can imagine that folks in Pakistan would point the finger. There are real political implications of making a move in this direction, because up until now, climate change has been seen as a common problem. We're all contributing to it. We're all somehow culpable. But when we get to solar geoengineering, where we can point to a handful of actors who are actually taking steps to try and intervene in planetary processes, then we get to some very, very thorny political issues.
Raymond Humbert at Oxford, you said it's a bad idea even to do research and experimentation. Is there any way, however, to stop it?
Oh, so I should give some nuance to that. There's some kinds of experimentation you just can't forbid without having a chilling effect on atmospheric research in general, the sort that we need, because there's a huge amount of overlap between fundamental atmospheric processes we need to understand better and the sort of things we need to understand in order, if anybody did want to do albedo modification, solar geoengineering. So the sort of experimentation that we were in favor of in the National Academy report was making good use of natural experiments, studying what happens after a volcanic volcanic eruption, which actually tests some of the global effects. Similarly, computer modeling, it would just have a chilling effect to forbid computer modeling. How much money a government should put into stimulating that is another question. But I think David's proposed experiment, although it's small and harmless from a physical standpoint, does cross a thin red line into doing it in an in-your-face way, saying we are going to do this in the atmosphere, and there's no governance right now other than what Harvard imposes on itself. They are doing an honest job in trying to impose some self-governance on this, but where do you draw the line? Who says what is an intolerably big experiment?
Okay, David, and Keith, what's your response to that? We're just about out of time. Go ahead.
Well, it's simply not the true that there's no governance. I think there's inadequate governance for experiments, and that's why we're trying to encourage the growth of that, but there absolutely is governance.
Beyond Harvard?
NEPA, the National Environmental Protection Act, is one of the instruments of governance, and that has the power in the end to put me in handcuffs. It's real. So we'll be working through the FAA and through NEPA to get a formal ruling through NEPA, and that absolutely, that's hard law. It's not just what we say at Harvard.
Okay. We're going to have to leave it at that, but thank you all very much for helping us better understand a subject I don't think many people have heard about before, which, however, we probably will be hearing a lot about as the days go by. David Keith at Harvard, again, where he is a solar geoengineering researcher. Raymond Pierre Humbert, professor of physics, University of Oxford. Simon Nicholson at the Forum for Climate Engineering Assessment. And Jack Stilgo the University College London and author of Experiment Earth, Responsible Innovation in Geoengineering. Many thanks to you all. In a moment, America's many divisions displayed through pictures of a cultural gathering place, McDonald's. This is To the Point from PRI. Well, we're only back with today's talking point. Chris Arnotti grew up in what he now calls the front row. With a Ph.D. in physics from Johns Hopkins University, he joined Solomon Brothers. But 5 years ago, in his late 40s, after 20 years on Wall Street, he rejected its values. He took a buyout from Citigroup and moved his family from Brooklyn to upstate New York. Now he's a photojournalist who travels the country in an 11-year-old Honda with a mattress in back, visiting, photographing, and talking with folks from the back row. Chris Arnotti, welcome to our studio.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us about the front row and the back row.
Yeah, I think currently we're a very divided country, and I think what I've seen in this country is the biggest division is about education, how much education you have. I call people who have elite educations, who have postgraduate degrees, front row kids. They tend to have gone to Harvard, have gotten PhDs like I did, end up working as lawyers, doctors, bankers like I did as well. And then there's a back row, people who I've met all across the country who have less than a college degree, or if they have a college degree, it usually comes from a combination of community colleges and trade schools. And I think that division, when I go into a town, I can tell you within 5 minutes if a town has an elite educational institution in it. It just changes the whole dynamic of the town and the whole feel of the town, the whole feel of the community.
What's wrong with the values in the front row?
I don't think there's anything particularly wrong. I think they're just very different. With education, with being in the front row comes a lot of status, both economic and cultural status, and a lot of privilege. And I think that privilege and that status, we tend to forget, those of us who are there, that we have a different worldview and we emphasize different things and we think we have a different value set than people who may not have that educational background. We emphasize career. Our primary meaning comes through career. We tend to be people who emphasize our morality is viewed as a function of rationality. We think about things in very rational terms. We tend to look down on faith or other forms of meaning. And we tend to move a lot. We tend to move for our careers. We don't think twice about moving overseas, moving across the coast. People in the back row, they tend to emphasize their meaning comes from local. From their place in the local community. They tend to move less. Often that's out of an obligation to their family, and their family and their community is what gives them meaning. As well as Michelle Lamont is a sociologist who talks about the working class, and she talks about the the morality of hard work, the decency of hard work. And that tends to be how people think of themselves, is how they rank themselves, how they think it. Were they good to their community? Are they good to their family? And do they work hard?
Don't people in the front row, though, do the same thing? They work hard. They value their work. They certainly value their families.
Well, they certainly do. But I think, again, it's an emphasis issue. It's, there is more status that comes from, again, moving for your for your job. There are plenty of people I've met in back road communities who will not leave their community out of an obligation to their family. There, just this morning, for instance, I was in a McDonald's in L.A. down in Whittier Boulevard, and I met a young girl who's 20, and she's going to the local community college. I believe it's called ELAC, East L.A. Community College. And she would like to go someplace else, but she said she can't because she's a translator for her mom, and she just can't leave. There are people – look, I left a back row town. I got up and left. I grew up in a small town like that, and I got up and went to college and left. Clearly, front row people value their families and care about their families, but I think, their morality is more driven by the question of did they do well at for their job.
What can people in the front row learn from people in the back row?
I think both can learn a lot from each other. I think the front row can learn. I think what's important for this political environment is to know that if you are in the front row, if you have this elite education, you have a lot more privilege than I think you recognize, or a lot of people recognize. I happen to think currently the front row is the in-group. They hold the power, both in terms of what is valuable politically and what is valuable culturally. And I think they can also recognize that, the people in the back row have a different worldview, a different value set that doesn't make them perhaps worse. It just makes them different.
You say people in the front row essentially are running the show, but didn't the people in the back row elect Donald Trump?
I think this is a case where there's a bit of a revolution going on in terms of I think that certainly the frustration of the back row with the front row has possibly resulted in Trump. Now, I just want to make clear that I did not vote for Trump and I don't approve of him.
So you're visiting McDonald's. You mentioned that here in Los Angeles. Why McDonald's?
My work started with working with a addiction across the country, and I found myself spending a lot of time in McDonald's. If you spend time with the homeless and people who are currently battling addiction, you'll find you spend a lot of time in McDonald's. And you do so because they're cheap. They provide cheap food, free Wi-Fi, clean bathrooms. But most of all, they provide a space, a kind of space where I say you can be in the public without being scolded. There's no judgment zone. You can just sit in your booth during the day and relax. And I started noticing that when I was in these McDonald's that I was using them the same way. I was using them for the free Wi-Fi to sit and relax. But I was also starting to meet people at McDonald's. And as I started going across the country, more and more I was in McDonald's, I started noticing they were effectively community centers. In the mornings, you would meet these groups of retirees, sometimes not just retirees, who get together for coffee, big groups, 16, 20 people. And in the evening, during the day, you would have people relaxing, spending their day. And at evening, you would have another form of community, basically people who don't have free, are too poor to have Wi-Fi, or kids going out in groups who use it as a social location.
That doesn't happen in the front row?
I think front row people tend to look at McDonald's a little bit differently. I think, to use an academic term, I think the front row views McDonald's as being kind of profane beneath them. Whereas in especially smaller communities or poorer communities and working class communities, McDonald's can function as essential in some ways.
How resentful are the people in the back row of the people in the front row?
Pretty bad. The kind of lack of understanding goes both ways. Again, I don't want to make a judgment of one of the other. It's just simply very different. There's a lot of people who left the back row who went to the front row because of intolerance of the back row. I think of, people who were slightly different, gay children. So this isn't, this isn't this island paradise, it's a very different – again, it's just very different worldviews that emphasize different things. And I think until we acknowledge the differences, we're going to never be able to bridge them.
You write and you take pictures. Describe some of the pictures you take. What are you trying to get out of your pictures?
I think I start off working with addicts and people – generally people, homeless people who were heroin addicts, to be blunt, and prostitutes. And what I wanted to do was by taking a picture, and I take what I consider, I say, conventional pictures of unconventional people. It's just normal pictures, almost like family photos. And I wanted to provide the person with a moment of dignity, people who generally we tend not to look at as people. I wanted them to kind of look at the camera straight on, traditionally lit, so that the reader, the viewer, could just look at them as a person without any judgment for 2 seconds, 3 seconds. And then provide a little story about that person, a little biography, to give some sense of who that person is. You know, we tend to, when we don't look at somebody, we tend to give them a narrative that's convenient for us. You know, if we see a homeless person or we see somebody we disagree with politically, we tend to say, well, that person must be weak, dumb, or something, intolerant, and, you know, without really giving them the benefit of the doubt.
People are blamed for their problems.
That's correct. Rather than blaming the system, I'm a good old-fashioned liberal where I believe you blame the system, not the person. We're a very divided country, and I don't want to diminish that. I think our divisions are growing. I think this current political environment is only expanding those divisions. But at least why continue to do that? Despite why don't get too depressed? Is I've put 200,000 miles on my car in the last 3.5 years driving across the country. I've been all over the country, and in every case, no matter where I am, no matter who I'm speaking to, I speak, you know, in churches, in minority communities, and in poor neighborhoods. Everybody has been kind to me. Everybody, and everybody shares a value. I guess what I call, you know, ultimately the American dream, is that they can live a life in which their children or their family is better off than them. And I think everybody wants that. We all want the share. We all share the same ultimate goal, which is to have a life where we can raise our children so that they're better than us, that they have a better life than us, and that they have a life in which they have, you know, peace and prosperity. So I think we all share the ultimate goal. It's just how we get there is the question.
Chris Arnotti, thank you so much for being on our program.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Orman Alney, and this is To the Point, broadcast live and podcast by KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.